Franz Joseph Haydn may be considered the father of the symphony, but in 1795, the impresario Johann Peter Salomon offered Haydn an anonymous libretto, something for which a symphonist would have no need. But this one piqued his interest. The title? The Creation of the World. I'm Colleen Phelps, and we'll talk to Nashville Symphony Chorus director Tucker Biddlecombe about preparing this massive work today on Keeping Score. The idea of a police presence at the premiere of a piece of orchestral music may conjure images of an angry crowd at the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, but a larger police presence was required at the premiere of Haydn's Creation. Schwarzenberg Palace was full with an audience of aristocrats, all seeking a preview of the piece before its official public premiere the next day. And police were needed to keep the composer's fans from storming in from outside. The composer himself conducted the premiere, often as overwhelmed as the audience. He said, "Sometimes my whole body was ice cold. Sometimes a burning heat came over me, and more than once, I was afraid I would suddenly have a stroke." The work was an incredible success for a while. During early performances, the audience interrupted with applause, and the piece was followed with long, wild ovations and rave reviews. But then as the 19th century progressed and music sensibilities turned toward the romantic, the piece came to be seen as trite in comparison. But it never completely left the repertoire. And today, it's a popular choice for professional, amateur, and academic choruses alike. Tucker Biddlecombe, like most choir directors, is pretty familiar with this piece. 2 years before preparing the Nashville Symphony Chorus, he conducted the piece with the choirs at Vanderbilt University. I sat with Tucker in his office at Vanderbilt early in the season when he was just getting started with the preparation.
It all starts with the introduction and the chaos where the chorus isn't even a part of things. And there's this orchestral tone poem 100 years before a tone poem was ever written that Haydn uses to describe the nothingness that the universe was before, you know, the creation. And it's so programmatic and descriptive. It's like you're looking through a musical telescope. You can hear the meteors flying, and you can just sort of hear harmonically he creates what the sound of nothingness is. It reminds me, or it was just to remind me of that high harmonic sound that you hear when a lot of snow is falling. And you can't really hear exactly the flakes hitting each other, but you can hear this sound, and it's hard to describe, and the music describes that beautifully, this sound of nothingness. It's always my hope that the audience is not going to expect when all of a sudden God turns on the light. There are a lot of scare moments in music that we always sort of hope happen, and I think this is one of the Haydn's earliest scare moments ever created in music, where he's lulling the audience into this sort of, oh, this is just going to be this beautiful, simple, easy piece, and then all of a sudden...
I'm going to read what a critic wrote about the premiere. At that moment when light broke out for the first time, one would have said that rays darted from the composer's burning eyes. The enchantment of the electrified Viennese was so general that the orchestra could not proceed for some minutes.
I wish I could go back and see what those performances were like, because they're so different now. You know, I think we're always trying to compact performances as much as we possibly can now, and I don't know why that is, because when you used to go to a concert, you know, 200 years ago, you were there. I mean, you were there for a long time, and I think that allows you, you know, that expectation allows you to take in a little bit more. You know, it reminds me of some stories I've heard about the Verdi Requiem, where the Dies Irae was, you know, asked to be encored five times the first time they ever heard it. And little did they know that they would hear it another five times, because it was built into the score. Those encores were built into the score. I just think it's the experience of hearing something for the first time, you know, hearing, no one had ever really done anything like that before, not successfully anyway. And because Haydn was successful in his own time, he always had audiences and he had good musicians, and he was able to have an audience that would react to something like that. You know, sometimes Mozart was, you know, doing things for opera houses that were just kind of common folk, and, you know, people were there kind of copying things down, and sometimes they would just take that performance and bring it somewhere else. And it was hard to get those sort of moments.
Well, and I noticed that Isaac Newton died in 1727, and then Creation was written in 1796, between 1796 and 1798. And I feel like there must have been this sort of feeling that he was taking an advanced look at the text through this new scientific knowledge of the stars.
I wonder if sometimes if Haydn looked through a telescope, you know, I wonder if he thought about things like that. But, you know, then I don't think it matters. I hear meteors in Chaos. I know they weren't. And I know that's not what he meant, but I think we can extrapolate that to now and sort of find our own current transfers. I wonder if he'd lived longer, what it would have sounded like after he had read Origin of the Species. You know, I don't think it would have changed his belief, just like it doesn't change a lot of people's beliefs. I know a lot of people who speak fluently in evolution and also go to church on Sunday, and they're not mutually exclusive, and there's not a cognitive dissonance there. It's, you know, I think an acceptance of a lot of different things in combination. And I don't think Haydn would have been swayed, but I think he would have found it really interesting. You'll be drawn to the harpsichordist who's I'm not quite sure if they're going to use a forte piano or if they use a harpsichord, but either one, you know, you'll be drawn to the character of that instrument and how it draws the action forward. And my hope is that you'll be drawn to the chorus, because the chorus plays a really, really critical role in this. It's not like a Greek chorus or something like that. It's sometimes moving the action forward, a little less reactionary, a little bit more integral to the story.
What's your favorite creature illustration moment in part two?
The worm. It's got to be the worm. At the end of the bass recitative, with sinuous trace, the worm. I can't even think that low to be able to sing that low D. But the worm crawling along the ground at the end, and it's understood, even though it's not written, that the bass is supposed to somehow, after singing essentially as a baritone role, you know, just have to pop out this low D and do it like it's nothing. But, you know, it really isn't. It's an amazing moment. It's one of those things that, again, perfectly describes what a worm wriggling along the ground feels like.
On Mighty Wings, when soprano sings with the flute, I'm taken back to... I go back to Gilbert and Sullivan all the time, and I'm taken back to the soprano aria in there where she goes back and forth with the flute. And I remember a performance where she stuck her head in the orchestra pit to kind of go, what is that? But she has that sort of back and forth, and it's like it could have been pulled straight out of the magic flute.
You know, music sometimes is supposed to be funny, and I think that moment is supposed to be funny.
It seems a little superficial, but I'm always curious if the soprano is going to change her dress between the second and third act.
It's not superficial at all. I think, you know, I've seen major differences. When different singers aren't used, I think you have to create some sort of difference, you know, especially, and boy, that's sometimes I'm jealous of the soprano, because a wardrobe change just never happens for the tenor. You know, it just always seems like the tenor just wears the same clothes. You know, whenever I see Carmen has like 18 costume changes and Don José has like one. So it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, not even in opera though, but in concert music, you know, there's so much, people write about what the women are wearing if they're playing a concerto or singing a solo. And some of that is, you know, who cares? And some of it is, you know, we can use that to our advantage in terms of what we're expressing. It's all part of the show.
There's an artistic advantage to any sort of visual representation that you can make. And you know, if I applaud people who use that stuff effectively, because it, you know, even a conductor, you know, coming out, I think that can really, really change the way that you're looking at music.
We, in percussion, we say people hear with their eyes.
Yeah. I got to use that sometimes this week. That's a good one. The visual aspect of creation is really interesting. I think people are going to be drawn to, they'll be drawn to the timpanist, who has a lot of particularly powerful moments.
Of course, everyone's always drawn to the timpanist. It comes with the territory. It comes with the mallets. You buy that with the mallets.
Spoken with no bias whatsoever. I think you'll be drawn to the timpanist. I think you'll be drawn to the brass players, who aren't just playing what's called colla parte. They have their own parts. They have their own, you know, they have their own intimate working in this piece, and they have their own color, which is really important.
So at Vanderbilt, you prepared a very different Let There Be Light moment a couple of years ago with Bernstein's Mass.
The interesting thing about doing Bernstein, and of course we'll hear a lot of Bernstein over the course of the next year, is that, you know, Haydn was a very devout person, and he treated this music and this text very literally and very seriously. And of course, Bernstein always dealt with everything with kind of a tongue firmly set in cheek. And Bernstein's Mass, you know, that moment of God said, let there be light, and there was light. You could almost sort of feel him kind of snapping and the lights turning on.
Let there be light, and there was light.
Let there be light.
Bernstein's use and sort of the way that he dealt with things in that Mass format was so set in that time. You know, you do Mass and you're transported back to the 70s, musically, text-wise, according to the plot. I don't think Creation does the same thing. I think it has a little more expansive time register.
It's time for a short break. You're listening to an excerpt of Leonard Bernstein's Mass, performed by the Norman Scribner Choir and baritone Alan Titus.
When you want to listen to classical music but aren't near a radio, 91 Classical is still your source for great performances from Middle Tennessee and around the world. Stream music on our website while you work. Tune in via the Nashville Public Radio app on your smartphone, or tell your smart speaker you'd like to hear 91 Classical.
Tucker Biddlecombe and I may have enjoyed the imagery of animals and surprise orchestral moments in Haydn's Creation, but we could also see moments of the profound in this score. To go with the illustration of the creatures and all the kind of whimsy that comes before it, to go straight to In Native Worth and Wonder Clad, is this reminder like, oh, yeah, still profound. This is still the father of the symphony here.
Well, you know, the tenor needs a heroic aria to sing, so that's
Do you think they put it in the contract?
I hope so. As a fellow tenor, I would expect to be able to sing a couple high G's really loud, and that's what you.
Once again, no bias at all.
No. I think, yeah, definitely. You're talking to two people who are completely, completely open to all instruments. In Native Worth, I think, was the first oratorio aria I ever sang. And, you know, taught me how to sing a high G without cracking. And when I say taught, I mean there were many, 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 many trials before I ever didn't crack on that G. But, of course, they were all alone by myself in a practice room with no witnesses. You know, it's a perfect representation. At times he's doing some things harmonically that are really outside the box, and then it's as if he wants to remind us, oh yeah, by the way, I'm great at this, and just creates this perfect, you know, little symphonic aria that and he does that with each of the voice parts. Everybody gets to do something.
Well, and I love the story about that at the end of his life, when he's on his deathbed and the city's invaded and the soldiers are keeping watch over him. And one of the invading soldiers asked to sing this aria for him.
You know, what do the kids say now? Hashtag life goals. I think that would be a good life goal. A good Verdi life goal, too. You know, when they're singing your songs outside your window when they know you're dying, you know, and they're singing, you know, va pensiero sola. Again, we don't do that stuff anymore. Although, you know, you never know. I mean, maybe when Beyonce goes, they'll be out there singing Single Ladies. You never know.
You can look at the choir and you can actually see Dr. Piddlecomb right in there.
That's right. I'll be in the tenor section, the one missing notes. I do like to sing with the choir. I'm not the kind of director who finds a lot of satisfaction sitting out in the audience. I'm not a super nervous person when it comes to performance. It's out of my hands at that point. There's nothing I can do. I'm a singer. You know, I love being in the chorus. I love experiencing it from that side. And, you know, when someone else takes the podium, I want to experience them as a conductor myself and know what sort of nuance they bring to it. But the other thing is I just like to experience it with my colleagues in the chorus. I just think that the work that they do is really exemplary. And, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, they always, don't you always need a screaming tenor in every choir? So I'm happy to contribute my whatever sound, whatever it may be.
That is one energetic chorus.
It is. It's fun to sing. I sang that in high school, actually. There was an all-state chorus that I sang in, and we couldn't sing the melisma, so the director had us sing it on doobie 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 doobie.
I think that's most people's first creation experience, that if you were a choir kid or in church choir, there's a chance you sang Awake the Harp.
One of the things I love most about this piece is its variety. There's an endless variety of styles of music. You'll hear every tool that he had in his toolbox as far as how to create a piece of music. And then you'll hear the tools that he created, the harmonic tools, the dissonances that he used to create the tension. The tempo relationships are very different. They're very unique to the text that's given. You'll hear beautiful classical type music that meets every expectation that you have. And then you'll hear things that you really didn't expect to hear, things that challenge your ears and take you to a different kind of place emotionally, which, again, I think probably his greatest gift to us is just the surprise that he gives us in this music.
Keeping Score is a production of Nashville Public Radio and 91 Classical. The show is edited by Nina Cardona. In this episode, we heard the Nashville Symphony's performance of Haydn's Creation, engineered by Gary Call. We also heard a short clip of the Norman Scribner Choir and baritone Alan Titus performing Leonard Bernstein's Mass. Be sure to set up your automatic download by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Next time, we'll talk to pianist Yefim Bronfman about a concerto he's played over 100 times. I'm Colleen Phelps. Thanks for listening to Keeping Score.